Okay, today I hope you had a reasonable quiet day after this morning's guided tour around the sites of Kusanara. No, I think it's okay. All right. And this afternoon we must be calm. Meditate, or just rest, whatever you need to do. This morning we'll be traveling to Rumbini, the birthplace of the Buddha. We're going a bit backwards, going to the place where the Buddha passed away first and the place where he was born afterwards. Usually you get born before he passed away, but we're doing the passing away first and the birth afterwards tomorrow. So that's just convenience. But I wanted to read out today from the Mahapadanibbana Sutta, which I was talking about earlier, some more of the details of actually what happened here in Kusanara. And there are some interesting details here. The book which I'm going to be reading from is a compilation anthology for the life of the Buddha done by Venerable Nyanamoli. So this is not all of what's in the Mahapadanibbana Sutta. In fact, there's some of it has been missed out. Some of my favourite stories have been missed out. But nevertheless, I'll maybe add them if it's at all possible later on. So here we go. This is from the Mahapadanibbana Sutta. Then the Blessed One said to the Venerable Ananda, "Come, Ananda, let us go to the further bank of the river Hiranyavati, to the Malian's solitary grove at the turn into Kusanara." "Even so, Lord," the Venerable Ananda replied. Then the Blessed One went with a large community of monks to the further bank of the Hiranyavati and onto the Malian's solitary grove at the turn into Kusanara. Then he said to the Venerable Ananda, "Ananda, please make a couch ready for me with its head to the north between the twin sala trees. I am tired and I will lie down." "Even so, Lord," the Venerable Ananda replied, and he did so. Then the Blessed One placed himself in the lion's sleeping pose on his right side with one foot overlapping the other, mindful and fully aware. So that's what it says, which is why that statue is in the lion's pose with its head facing north. Now on that occasion the twin sala trees were quite covered with blossoms, though it was not the season. They scattered and sprinkled and strewed them on the Blessed One's body out of veneration for him. And even heavenly flowers and sandalwood powder fell from the sky and were strewn over the Blessed One's body out of veneration for him. And heavenly music was played and heavenly songs were sung in the sky out of veneration for him. Then the Blessed One sent the Venerable Ananda, "Ananda, the twin sala trees are quite covered with blossoms. They scatter and sprinkle through them over the Perfect One's body out of veneration for him. And heavenly flowers and heavenly sandalwood fall from the sky and scatter and sprinkle and spoon over the Perfect One's body out of veneration. And heavenly music is played and heavenly songs are sung in the sky out of veneration for him." And now comes the important line. "But this is not how a Buddha is honored, respected, revered, venerated or reverenced. Rather, it is the monk or the nun or the man or woman lay follower who lives according to the Dhamma, who enters upon the proper way and walks in the Dhamma. That honors, respects, reveres and venerates the Buddha with the highest veneration of all. Therefore, Ananda, train us. We will live in the way of Dhamma, entering upon the proper way and walking in the Dhamma." Very favourite quote. That's how you pay reverence, how you worship the Buddha. So we did actually put some candles and incense at all the places, but that's not the real highest blessing. The real highest blessing was done by all of you keeping the five precepts, by meditating this afternoon. That is the highest way to venerate the Buddha. And one of the other stories, which is not in here but in the commentary, is Venerable Dhammarama. Dhammarama means the one who delights in the Dhamma. Because at this particular time, when actually just beforehand, when the Buddha said he was going to pass away, the 3 months Dhammarama could not be seen, one of the Buddha's disciples. And the other monks complained to the Buddha, saying, "This disciple of yours, Dhammarama, he's not doing any duties, he's not attending on you, he's not coming to listen to the final instructions." And of course the Buddha knew why. But nevertheless, he said, "Okay, summon Dhammarama to me." And so here in Kusinara, he summoned Dhammarama and said, "Dhammarama, why have you neglected your duties? Why haven't you come to attend on me, your teacher? Why haven't you come to listen to your final instructions?" And Dhammarama said, "I have been attending to you. Because you said, even here, the highest veneration is to practice according to the Dhamma. When I heard you are shortly to pass away into Parinibbana, I had not yet attained even Sotapanna. So I decided, I've been meditating day and night, practicing according to the Dhamma. That is what I've been doing all this time." And the Buddha said, "Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. That's how you pay respects to the Buddha. By living in the way of the Dhamma, entering upon the proper way, and walking in the Dhamma," as it says here. So always remember that that's the highest veneration. It's easy to go around walking three times. It's easy to offer candles and flowers. It's even easy to offer money. It's easy to bow or offer a robe over the statue here at Kusinara. But the highest veneration, what the Buddha said in this very place, is to venerate the Buddha by practicing the Dhamma. Just then, however, the Venerable Upawana was standing in front of the Blessed One, fanning him. Then the Blessed One dismissed him, saying, "Go away, monk, do not stand in front of me." Then the Venerable Ananda thought, "The Venerable Upawana has long been an attendant of the Blessed One, near to him and closely associated with him. Yet at the last moment, the Blessed One dismisses him, saying, 'Go away, monk.' What's the reason for this?" And so he asked the question of the Blessed One, who replied, "Ananda, most of the devas from the 10 world systems have come to see the Perfect One. For 12 leagues all around the Sada Tree Grove, there is not a place the size of the picking of a horse hair's tip not occupied by devas. They are protesting. 'We have come from far to see the Buddha. Every now and then, Perfect Ones arise in the world, accomplishing full enlightenment. Tonight, in the last watch, the Buddha's attainment of Parinibbana will take place. And thus, this eminent monk is standing in front of the Blessed One, obstructing us. So at the last moment, we shall not be able to see the Blessed One. The devas are protesting among them. But Lord, what devas has the Blessed One in mind?" There's the devas who are, actually just all the devas, he was saying. There are devas who are percipient of earth in space. They are tearing their hair and weeping, stretching out their arms and weeping, falling down and rolling back and forth, crying out, "So soon the Buddha will attain Parinibbana. So soon the Buddha will attain Parinibbana. So soon the eye will vanish from the world." And there are devas, or the other devas, who are doing likewise. But those devas who are free from lust resign themselves, mindful and fully aware. Formations are impermanent. How could it be that what is born, come to being, formed and bound to fall, should not fall? That is not possible, to understand impermanence. Lord, formerly monks who had spent the rains in different parts came to see the Blessed One, so we were able to see and able to show respect. But Lord, when the Blessed One has gone, we shall not be able to do so anymore. Ananda, and this is an important story here, Ananda, there are four places for a faithful person to see, which may be his inspiration once the Buddha passed away. What are the four? Here, the Buddha was born. That is a place for faithful people to see, which may be their inspiration. Here, the Buddha discovered the supreme full enlightenment. That is a place for people to see, which will be for their inspiration. Here, the Blessed One, the Buddha, set rolling the matchless wheel of the Dhamma. That is a place for faithful people to see, which will be for inspiration. And here the Buddha attained final Nibbana. with a nirvana element without remainder. And that is the place for faithful people to see, which may be for the inspiration. Faithful monks and nuns, laymen and laywomen, will come saying, here the Blessed One was born, here the Blessed One discovered the Supreme Enlightenment, here the Blessed One set rolling the wheel of the Dhamma, and here the Blessed One attained final nirvana. And for those who travel to visit such shrines with confident hearts, and all those, it says here, all those who travel to visit such shrines with confident hearts will reappear on the dissolution of their body after death in a happy destination, even in the heaven world. So this is what the Buddha is saying. Now what are those four places? What is the place where the Buddha was born? Have we been there yet? Tomorrow. Where was the place, it says here, where the Buddha sat rolling the matchless wheel of the Dhamma? Oh no, I've got that place here. Where did the Buddha discover the Supreme Full Enlightenment? Have we been there yet?
Yes.
Yeah, that's one off. Where was the place where the Buddha sat rolling the matchless wheel of the Dhamma? Sarna, the deer park of Benares. Have we been there yet?
No.
That's coming soon. And the last place where the Buddha attained final enlightenment, that's here. So we've done two out of four so far. Three out of four tomorrow, and the fourth will be done in a few days' time. It says here, all those who travel to visit such shrines will reappear on the dissolution of the body after death, in a happy destination, even in the heaven world. But Lord, how do we treat the Blessed One's remains? Not to do with the matters. Ananda, do not preoccupy yourself about venerating the Buddha's remains. Strive for your own goal. Devote yourself to your own goal. Grow diligent, ardent, and self-control for your own good. There are wise warriors and Brahmins and householders who believe in the Blessed One. They will seek to venerating the Blessed One's remains. But Lord, how should one treat the Blessed One's remains? So he didn't get the right answer. But now he asked another question and got a better answer. Treat the Blessed One's remains in the same way as the remains of a universal monarch. But Lord, how shall one treat the remains of a universal monarch? They wrap his remains in a new cloth. Then they wrap them in a well-beaten coffin. Then they wrap them in new cloth. And proceeding in this way, they wrap them in 500 twin layers. Then they place them in an iron oil vessel, which they close with another vessel. Then they make a pyre with all kinds of scents and burning remains. Then they build a monument, a stupa to him at the four crossroads. That is how they treat the remains of a universal monarch. And the perfect one's remains should be treated in the same way. The Buddha's monument should be built at the four crossroads, and whoever shall put flowers or scents on it, or whitewash it, or shall worship it, or feel confidence in their heart, that will be long for their welfare and happiness. There are these four who are worthy of a monument, a stupa. What for? A Buddha, accomplishing full enlightenment, number one. A Pacheka Buddha, this is like a silent Buddha who does not teach, and who is also a perfect one's disciple who is an arahat. Sorry, that's number two. Number three is a Buddha's disciple who is an arahat, Sri Buddha Moggallana. And lastly, a universal monarch who turns the wheel of righteousness. And what is the aim in view of which any of these four is worthy of a monument? There are many who feel confidence in their hearts, thinking this is a monument to that Buddha, or this is a monument to that Pacheka Buddha, or this is a stupa, a chaitya, to that arahat, or this is a stupa to this world, to this wheel-turning monarch. And when they feel confidence in their hearts there, then on the dissolution of their body after death, they will reappear in a happy destination, even in the heavenly world. Then the Venerable Ananda went inside a dwelling, and he stood leaning against the door bar and wept. I am still only a learner, whose task was yet to be completed. My teacher is about to attain parinibbana. My teacher, who has compassion on me. very sad. The Buddha was about to die. And in that Parinibbana temple, you saw the pictures of the three people on the face. The one on the right was a monk crying. Maybe Ananda. Then the Blessed One asked the monks, "Monks, where's Ananda gone?" "Lord, he has just gone inside a dwelling, and he is standing again, leaning against the door bar, weeping. I am still only a learner whose task is yet to be completed. My teacher is about to attain Parinibbana, my teacher who has compassion on me." So the Blessed One told the monk, "Come, monk, go to Ananda, say to my name. That teacher calls you, friend Ananda." So Ananda got summoned to the Buddha. And so Ananda came, he paid respects to the Buddha, stood at one side, the Blessed One said to him, "Enough, Ananda. Do not sorrow, do not lament. Have I not already repeatedly told you that there is separation and parting and division from all that is dear and beloved? How could it be that what is born, come to being, formed and bound to fall, should not fall or fade away? That is not possible. Ananda, you have long and constantly attended on the Buddha, with bodily acts of loving kindness, helpful, gladly, sincerely and without reserve, and so too with verbal and mental acts. You have made merit, Ananda. Keep on endeavouring and you will soon be free from all the asanas." Who is predicting Ananda's enlightenment. Then the Buddha addressed the monks thus, "Monks, the accomplished fully enlightened ones in the past also had attendants who were to them what Ananda is to me, and the Buddhas in the future also will have attendants such as Ananda. Ananda is wise, monks. He knows this is the time for monks to come and visit the Buddha. This is the time for nuns. This is the time for laymen and laywomen to come and visit the Buddha. He is wise." When he had spoken thus, the Venerable Ananda said, "Lord, let the Buddha not attain Parinibbana in this little mud-walled town. This backwards town, this branch township. There are great cities like Champa, like Rajagaha, Sarvati, where we're going after tomorrow, Saketa, Kosambi, and Benares. Let the Blessed One attain Parinibbana there, where there are many prominent nobles, Brahmins, householders who believe in the Blessed One. They will venerate the Blessed One's remains." "Do not say so, Ananda. Do not say a little mud-walled town, a backwards town, a branch township." That's where we are now. "There was once a king called Sudarsana the Great. He was a righteous universal monarch who turned the wheel of righteousness, a conqueror of the four quarters, who had stabilized his country and who possessed the seven treasures. His capital city was Kusinara, then called Kusawati." What's his town called now? It was called Kusia. Kusia. That was actually when the British found it. It was called Kusia. But Kusinara at the time, the Buddha Kusawati a long time ago. "And it was 12 leagues wide from east to west, and 7 leagues broad. The royal capital, Kusinara, was as mighty and prosperous, with as many inhabitants and as crowded with people and full of plenty as the royal capital city of the gods." So just saying what a great city this was in the past. "Now, Ananda, go into Kusinara and announce to the Malas of Kusinara, tonight, in the last watch, the Buddha will attain final nirvana. Come forth, Malas, come forth, lest you regret it later and think the Buddha's attainment of Parinibbana took place in our own town precincts, and we did not go to see the Buddha in the last hour." "Even so, Lord." And so Ananda went there and told the Malas. And when this was heard from the Venerable Ananda, the Malas with the young men and maidens and matrons and were dismayed and aghast. Overcome by grief, some tore their hair and wept. Some stretched out their arms and wept. Some fell down and rolled back and forth, crying out. That's what it says. "So soon the Buddha will attain Parinibbana. So soon the Buddha will attain Parinibbana. So soon the eye will vanish from the world." Dismayed and aghast, overcome by grief as they were, The Malas with the young men and maidens and matrons went to the Venerable Ananda in the Malas Saltu Grove, returning to Kusinara. Then Ananda thought, if I let the Malas of Kusinara salute the Blessed One singly, the night will be over before they can finish. Suppose I get them to salute the Blessed One with a single representative for each clan thus. Lord, the Malian named so-and-so with his children, his wife, his retinue and his friends salutes the Blessed One with his head and the Blessed One's feet. And he did so, and in that way he got them all through in the first watch of the night. However, a wanderer called Subhadra was staying in Kusinara at the time. He heard, tonight in the last watch the monk Gotama's attainment of Parinibbana will take place. And he thought, I have heard from senior elders, teachers amongst the wanderers, this is another sect of the time of Buddha, that Buddhas appear in the world from time to time, accomplished and fully enlightened. And tonight, in the last watch, the monk Gotama's attainment of Parinibbana will take place. While there is this doubt in me, yet I still have confidence in this monk Gotama, that he can teach me the Dhamma in such a way that I can rid myself of this doubt. So he went to the Marasalpi Grove, at the turn to Kusinara, he approached the Reverend Ananda and told him all that had occurred to him, saying, if only I might see the monk Gotama, Master Ananda. Then Ananda said, enough, friend Subhadra, do not trouble the Buddha, the Blessed One is tired. The wanderer made the same request a second time and received the same reply. And the Blessed One heard their conversation, so he told Ananda, enough Ananda, do not keep Subhadra out. Let him see the Perfect One. Whatever he may ask of me, he will ask it only for the sake of knowledge, if not to cause trouble. And what I can tell him, he will quickly understand. So the Venerable Ananda ushered Subhadra into Buddha's One's presence. And Subhadra asked, Master Gotama, there are these monks and their Brahmins, each with their own community, with their own group, leading a group, each a renowned and famous philosopher, reckoned by many as a saint. I mean, Purana Kassapa, Makari Gotala, Ajita Kesambala, Paikuta Kachayana, Sanjaya Bharatissa, and the Niganta Nathaputta, last of which was Mahavira, the leader of the Jains. Have they all had direct knowledge, as they claim? Or have none of them had direct knowledge, as they claim? Or some have and some haven't? In other words, are they all enlightened, or they are just pretending? Enough, Subhadra. Whether they have all attained arahatship or not, let that be. I shall teach you Dhamma, Subhadra. Listen to ten carefully. Subhadra, in whatever Dhamma and discipline, in other words, any practice, any religion, the Noble Eightfold Path is not found. There, the four stages of enlightenment are not found. In whatever Dhamma and discipline, the Noble Eightfold Path is found. Then the four stages, the Supreme Wind, the Ones Returned, the Non-Returned, and the Arahat, are there found. And the Buddha carries on, the Noble Eightfold Path is found in this Dhamma and discipline, Subhadra, and so it is here that the four stages of enlightenment are found. Aged 29, Subhadra, I went forth. This is what the Buddha said. If these monks in this discipline live rightly, this is an important saying, and if the monks live rightly, in other words, keep the follow the Eightfold Path, the world will not be devoid of arahats, the accomplished ones. The world will not be devoid of arahats. And the Buddha says a poem, age 29, Subhadra, I went forth, seeking after what is wholesome. And more than 50 years have now gone by. He was 80. Since then, Subhadra, the time when I went forth, outside this dispensation, never a monk is there who treads the way of Dhamma, even in part. Nor is there... Okay, this is already been said. Then the wanderer Subhadra said, magnificent Lord, the Dhamma has been made clear in many ways. And he went forth as a monk. And usually, as I mentioned in a sutta yesterday, if a person has been another sect, they have to be on probation for 4 months. And he said, "Oh, well, I'd be on probation for 4 years." So with that humility, the Buddha ordained him straight away. So actually, the Buddha told him about Ananda. Ananda, give Subhadra the going forth as Pabaja, even so, Lord. Then the wanderer said to the venerable Ananda, "It is a gain for you, friend Ananda. It is a gain, great gain, that you have been anointed here in the Master's presence with the pupil's anointment." In other words, that the Buddha said he was worthy of ordaining others. And so the wanderer Subhadra received the going forth under the blessed... Anyhow, it says over here, I have to check this one, because it makes sense. Then the wanderer received the going forth under the blessed one, even though he told Ananda to do it. And he also received the admission of being the full mark. Then not long after his admission, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and self-controlled, the venerable Subhadra, by realizing himself with distinct, direct knowledge, here and now entered upon and dwelt in the attainment of Arahat. Then the Blessed One addressed the Venerable Ananda. "Ananda, you may think, the word of the teacher is a thing of the past. Now we have no more teacher. But you should not regard it so. The Dhamma and the Vinaya taught by me and laid down for you are your teacher after I have gone. Up until now, monks have addressed each other with the word friend, but it should not be done after I have gone. A senior monk should be addressed, should address a junior monk by this name, or his family, or his friend. A junior monk, friend means I also. A junior monk should address a senior monk as Bante, or Ayazama. The Sangha can, if it wishes, abolish the lesser and minor rules when I am gone. And the higher penalty should be imposed on the monk Channa when I am gone. But Lord, what is the higher penalty?" This is actually the story of Channa, who was a Buddha's charioteer, who also went forth as a monk, but he was very, very proud, would only be taught by the Buddha, and would be bad-mouthing other monks. So the higher penalty was what we call these days, standing to commentary. No other monk could address it. It later worked. After the Buddha passed away, he became an arahant. Then the Blessed One addressed the monks thus: "Monks, it may be that some monks have a doubt or a problem concerning the Buddha, or the Dhamma, or the Sangha, or the path, or the way of progress. Ask monks, so that you may not regret it afterwards." When this was said, the monks were silent. A second time, and a third time, the Buddha asked, "Is there any questions?" And when this was said, they were silent. And Venerable Ananda said to the Buddha, "It is wonderful, Lord, it is marvellous. I have such confidence in this Sangha of monks, and I believe there is not one monk with a doubt or a problem concerning the Buddha, the Dhamma, or the Sangha." "You, Ananda," said the Buddha, "speak out of confidence, but the Buddha has knowledge that here in this Sangha of monks there is not one monk who has any doubt concerning the Buddha, Dhamma, or the Sangha, the path of the way of progress. The most backwards of these 500 monks is a stream winner, no more subject to lower realms, certain of progress and destined for enlightenment." Then the Buddha addressed the monks thus: "Indeed, monks, I declare this to you. It is in the nature of all formations to dissolve, attain perfection through diligence." This is the last words of the Buddha. Vaya Dhamma Sankara, Apamadena Sampadeta. Many, many different translations of those very important words. Sankara is anything which is formed, not just the body, but also the mental sankaras. They are the nature to fade away, to change. And apamadena, through diligence, sampadeta, to progress on the path. I have here attained perfection through diligence. This was the Buddha's last utterance. Then the Blessed One entered upon the first jhana, and then the second jhana, then the third jhana, then the fourth jhana, then the infinity of space, the infinity of consciousness. These are the immaterial attainments. And then the base of nothingness, and then the base of neither perception or non-perception. And from there, he went into the cessation of perception and feeling. Then Ananda said to Venerable Aniruddha, "Lord, the Buddha has attained Parinibbana." "No, friend," said Aniruddha, who had the psychic powers of being able to read minds. He said, the blessed one has not attained final nirvana, he has attained the cessation of perception and feeling. Then the Buddha emerged from that cessation of perception and feeling, entered upon the base of neither perception nor non-perception, emerging from that entered upon the base consisting of nothingness, emerging from that entered upon the base consisting of the infinity of consciousness, emerging from that he entered upon the base consisting of the infinity of space, he was going backwards to the immaterial jhanas, emerging from that he entered the fourth jhana, from fourth to third, third to second, second to first, and from first back to second, second to third, third to fourth jhana, and then emerging from the fourth jhana, the Blessed One entered Parinibbana, or attained Parinibbana. And as mere some monks say, if you know what these jhanas are all about, some monks actually mention that that's the way that all arahats exit from samsara, via the fourth jhana. When the Buddha's attainment of final nirvana, there was a great earthquake, fearful and hair-raising, and the drums of heaven resounded. With the Blessed One's attainment of nirvana, Brahma Sahampati uttered this stanza, no being in the world but shall lay down the temporary compound of its person, and even such a teacher without peer in all the world, perfected with the powers, enlightened, has attained complete extinction. When, that's Brahma Sahampati, but what Sakha said next is worth reading. When the Blessed One's attainment of final nirvana, Sakha, the ruler of the gods of the 33, uttered this stanza, formations are impermanent, their very nature is to rise and fall, and there is none arises but must cease. True bliss lies in this stilling. That's the Anicca Vatasankara, Upadavaya Dhammano, Upajita Maniurjanti, Tezang Upasamo Sukho, which we chanted in the Parinibbana, Mahaparinibbana temple. And with the Blessed One's attainment of Parinibbana, and that's actually the stanza which we use at all funeral services to this day. With the Blessed One's attainment of Parinibbana, the Venerable Anuruddha uttered this stanza, one even such as he, his mind at rest, remained bereft of breathing, having no wants. The seer completes his time and intent on peace. He bore his feelings with untrammeled heart. His heart's release is like a flame's extinction. It's a beautiful saying. The heart's release like a flame being extinguished. And with the Blessed One's attainment, that's all the gods and Anuruddha, which now have now Ananda's verses. On attainment of final nirvana, Ananda uttered this verse. Oh, then there was paralyzing fear. Oh, then one's hair stood up with horror. The enlightened ones, supremely graced, attained the ultimate extinction. So he was still about to accept. And with the Blessed One's attainment of Parinibbana, some monks who were not without lust stretched out their arms and wept, and they fell down and they rolled back and forth. While other monks, who were free from lust, mindful and fully aware, said, formations are impermanent. How could it be that what is born, come to being, formed and bound to fall, should not pass away? That is not possible. Then the Anuruddha addressed the monks, enough monks, do not sorrow, do not lament. Hasn't the Dhamma been taught by the Buddha? And the deities are protesting at your behavior. But Lord, what sort of deities are the Venerable Anuruddha to mind? And he talks about all the deities who are protesting about the monks rolling back and forth. Then the Venerable Anuruddha and Venerable Ananda spent the rest of the night in talk on Dhamma. Anuruddha said to the Venerable Ananda, go for him, go into Kusinara and announce the malas. Malas, the Blessed One has attained final nirvana. Now is the time for you to do as you think fit. And so he went there. And the Malas met together in the assembly hall, and when they were said, they were overcome by grief again. And the Malas gave them orders, collect scents and flowers and all the instruments of music in Kusinara. And they took scents and flowers and musical instruments, and also 500 lengths of cloth to where the Blessed One's body lay in the Malas sanitary grove. And they spent that day in paying honour, respect, reverence and veneration for the Blessed One's body with dances, songs, music, garlands and scents. and in making cloth canopies and pavilions. They thought, it is too late now to cremate the Buddha's body, we shall do it tomorrow. And so they passed the second day, the third day, the fourth day, the fifth and the sixth days. On the seventh day they thought, let us bear the Blessed One's body southwards, outside the town, to a place south of the town. So we know where they took it. We can actually see that the old Kusinara is north of the cremation sticker. So let us to a place south of the town, paying honour, respect, reverence and veneration to the Buddha's body. So they eight leading mothers bathed their heads, put on new garments, and thinking to lift up the Buddha's body, they could not do it. They asked the Venerable Aniruddha the reason. You, Vasettas, have one intention, while the deities have another. What is the deity's intention? Your intention, Vasettas, is this blessed, to bear the Blessed One's body southwards, outside the town. But the deity's intention, let us bear the Blessed One's body northwards, to the north of the town. Actually, that I was wrong there, the town was actually south from here. Let us take it out in the south of the town, let's finish off here. Let us bear the Blessed One's body northwards, to the north of the town, and... Okay, here we go. The deity's intention, let us bear the Blessed One's body northwards, to the north of the town, paying honour, respect, reverence and veneration, and then entering by the north gate, let us bear it to the middle of the town, after which let us go to the east gate, and there, where the Malas have a shrine called Makuta Bandana to the east of the town, there let us have the Blessed One's body burnt. Lord, let it be as the deity's intent. Actually, that's supposed to be the east of the town. So in other words, the town would be to the west. That makes sense. Now at that time, Krishna was all strewn knee-deep with heavenly flowers. So paying respect, reverence and veneration to the Blessed One's body, they took it to the Makuta Bandana shrine to the east of the town. There they set it down. Then they asked how to cremate the Buddha's body, and he told them with all those cloths. So they did that. Now at that time, Venerable Mahakasapa was travelling on the high road towards Kusinara with a large number of monks, with 500 monks. Then they saw one of these heavenly flowers, and so then he saw an ascetic coming with one of these heavenly flowers, and then Mahakasapa said, where did you get the heavenly flower from? And the ascetic said, I got it from the teacher, the monk Gotama, or from the place where the monk Gotama attained Fire Nirvana 7 days ago. That is how I got this heavenly flower. And so some of the monks were not free from lust, wept. Other ones were quite equanimous. And this is an interesting one. But there was one sitting in the assembly with Mahakasapa. Actually, didn't have a name, another Subhadra, another one who just became enlightened. This was a Subhadra who had gone forth in old age. He said to those monks, enough friends, do not sorrow, do not lament. We are well rid of this great monk. We have been frustrated by him saying, this is allowed to you, this is not allowed to you. But now that Master Gotama is gone, we shall do as we like, and we shall not do as we do not like. Then the Venerable Mahakasapa addressed the monks thus, enough friends, do not sorrow, do not lament. All things are impermanent. And it's actually that saying of that monk was overheard by Mahakasapa, and that was the reason they had the council very quickly after the Buddha's Parinirvana. So four leading mothers decided to light the fire. However, they could not do so. So they asked them, Ananda, why? And he said, because the devas have a different intention. What is the devas' intention? The devas are waiting for Mahakasapa to arrive. So they waited. And when the Venerable Mahakasapa arrived, he paid homage with one robe, with one his shoulder over one, his robe over one shoulder, and raising his right palms together, he circumambulated the pyre three times to the right. And then the Blessed One's feet were revealed, and he saluted the Blessed One's feet with his head. And the 500 monks arranged the robes on the shoulder, and they did exactly the same. And as soon as those 500 had finished, the pyre caught a light by itself. The day was ready to light it. And just as when butter or oil burns, it produces neither cinder nor ash, so too in the burning of the Blessed One's body, neither the outer skin nor the inner skin, nor the flesh, nor the sinews, nor the oil of the joints produce any cinder or ash, only the bones remain. And of the 500 twin wrappings, only two were burned, the innermost and the outermost. When the Blessed One's body was consumed, a cascade of water poured down from the sky. In other words, it rained. Then the Malas kept the Blessed One's bone in the assembly hall for 7 days. And soon King Ajatasattu of Magadha heard, "The Blessed One has passed away." Then he sent an envoy to the Malas, saying, "I am worthy of a share of the Blessed One's bones. I will build a monument and hold a ceremony." And the Lichavis of Visali, we went there the other day, heard likewise, saying, "The Blessed One was a warrior. We too are warriors. We too are worthy of share of the Blessed One's bones." And the Sakyans of Kapilavatthu said, "The Blessed One was the greatest of our kin. We too are worthy of a share of the Blessed One's bones. We too will build a monument." And the Bullions of Alakapaka didn't actually mention anywhere else. So the Blessed One was a warrior, we too, we want a shrine. The Kolians of Ramagama wanted one, and the Brahmin of Weta heard likewise. The Malians of Parva heard likewise, they wanted one. And so when all these great kingdoms sent envoys wanting a share of the relics, the Malas assembled and answered, "The Blessed One attained final nirvana in the precincts of our tower. We will not give up the bones of the Blessed One." So they had a Brahmin called Dona address the assembled group with these words, "Sirs, hear a word from me. Our awakened one, preach patience. So it is not right that we should now come to clash over a share of the bones. Sirs, let us all unite in harmony and in agreement to make up 8 parts, let monuments be set up far and wide, that many may gain trust in the Buddha. Then, Brahmin, you yourself shall divide up and distribute the Blessed One's bones fairly into 8 equal parts. Even so, sirs, they replied, and divided up and distributed the bones fairly into 8 equal parts. Then they asked the assembled group. Then Dona asked the assembled group, "Give me this vessel, sirs, I too will build a monument and hold a ceremony." And they gave the Brahmin the vessel which held the Buddha's bones. And then last of all, the Mauryans of Pipalawana heard, "The Blessed One has attained final nirvana at Kusinara." They sent an envoy and demanded a share of the bones, but they were too late. There was no share of the Blessed One's bones left. They have all been distributed. However, you may take the ashes from here. So they took the ashes. And each one of these held a great ceremony and built a monument to the Blessed One's relics. And those were the 8 stupas which were built in those early years. And we see some of those stupas. We've already seen a couple of them. Now we'll see a few more later on. And last of all, in a couple of days, we'll see an important one and see the relics from there, which are now in the Delhi Museum. So that is from the sutras, the very early sutras, the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. So it's a very early record of what happened here many, many years ago. It's a long little sutra I read out today. The whole lot takes a long time to read. But are there any questions or comments about the sutta? Sir? Yeah? Well, I think that Yeah, I suppose that's okay, because I think the Buddha would have accepted for the faith of people that instead of just building a monument over the whole lot, eight monuments is eight times as good. I think Asoka realised that even many more than that is very good. So he also built many, many monuments. What is interesting though from that story is that this is pretty much original. So some of it has obviously been added to. There's something called hagiography, where they tend to take the original story and add magical, marvellous things to it later on. But the important parts of the story are that the Buddha actually passed away here, between the twin sal trees. Important parts of the story are that some monks, even students of the Buddha, still hadn't really understood impermanence and actually was sorrowful and were weeping at the time when the Buddha passed away. What was true at that time was that after the death, the Malas would have actually celebrated, even with songs and music. That's just the way that they did things. Even though the Buddha said very carefully, and that this is also a true thing, that's not the way you honour a Buddha, just by song and dance, or by music, or by flowers and incense. The best way is by practice. Now obviously that's in the spirit of the Buddha, of all the things he taught in the past. But nevertheless, he would just allow that to happen. They told Ananda, don't worry about the body. The lay body, and looking after the lay people, figure that out. And so he wasn't really concerned about his body remains. He realised that was a good thing for lay people to look after. And what else was there? There was the taking the body to the east to be cremated, but it was cremated there. And there was the distribution of the relics into eight portions, which would have happened. And there was also Mahakasapa coming, and that word from the monk who said, it's good the Buddha's now died, the one who laid down all these rules, telling us what to do and what not to do, we're well rid of him, now we can do what we want. That also sounds that so true to human nature, that would obviously would have happened. One of the things you do find when you read these suttas in detail, especially the Vinaya, you find that human nature hasn't changed over all these years. Maybe that, you know, the people have different livelihoods, but their nature is exactly the same. Yeah. Yes, yeah, go on, yeah. I would think when he said what it meant by practicing Dhamma, entering upon the way, is actually the whole path, the Eightfold Path. He said entering upon the path, the Magga, and it's the Eightfold Path would be what he meant. So by practicing, it's not just practicing Dhamma, but it's not eliminating the practice of Dhamma. It's not just keeping precepts. It's not forgetting about the precepts. It's not just meditating. It's not forgetting about meditation. It's the whole works. The whole works is the path, not just part of the path. So he wanted the monks. That's why I mentioned the story of Dhammarama, the monk who never attended upon the Buddha because he was just devoted to his meditation. He also was keeping his precepts as well. The whole path is what's important. That's a nice little saying. The other saying, which is obviously very important, was the saying about that in any place where there's the Eightfold Path being practiced, there you will find arahats. As long as the Eightfold Path has been practiced, this world will not be devoid of arahats. But sometimes people, there was, especially in Sri Lanka, it was taught when you were young in Sri Lanka that nowadays there can be no more arahats because some things have changed and you can't have enlightened beings anymore. And that is one of the reasons for the decline of Buddhism in that country. But here you see, wherever the Eightfold Path has been practiced, there you find arahats, enlightened beings. And anagamis, sakadagamis, and stream winners. So, if you practice the Eightfold Path in Sri Lanka or Australia or New Zealand or Thailand or wherever, then you will find three winners, one returners, none returners, and arahats. Important statement, as the Buddha said. As long as there are people practicing the Eightfold Path, there will be arahats around. Yeah? Can you shout it out? Aha, what did he mean by you may abolish the lesser and minor rules? No one could find out what he said. But he also said other things as well. Because that's one of the controversies which the monks talked about at the first council. They said, what are those lesser and minor rules? They couldn't even decide amongst themselves what those lesser and minor rules were. But they also reminded, the Buddha also said on another occasion, that the monks should not abolish any rules, nor should they make any new rules. They should live in accordance with the rules which are already laid down. So there seemed to be a little controversy there. And so they said, it was not one important thing, they said that a monk, a single monk, can't abolish the rules, it had to be the whole Sangha. The Sangha may, if it like, not one monk. So I can't abolish any rules. But if all monks meet together, then we can. So they met together in the first council. And they decided not to. So they may, but they decided not to. Make sense? Yeah.
I was surprised this morning when you said that Radhapan here was no one person.
Okay, you're asking why is this the most special place? Well, I said that this morning. I like to stir people up a bit and do things you haven't heard before, so it makes you think a bit more. I was going to mention this at Lumbini tomorrow, because according to the sutras, this is a very early statement that Siddha Buddha actually said when he was born, this is my last life. You wonder how can a person know that this was their last life when they were born, knowing impermanence. And it's because of statements like that and other reasons that many people in the time just after the Buddha, the Socraticus, one of the great sects, had the idea that the Buddha was a once returner when he was born into this life. Certainly, that we know from the sutras that one of the Buddha's previous lives was as a monk called Jotapala under Buddha Kassapa. And that's a very recent time. And it says that he lived his full life after that birth in the Tishasaram. To me, anybody who lived under Buddha, who had that degree of karma from the past, would have at least attained something. He used to be a stream winner. And when the Buddha was born, because he could say at his birth, this is my last life, that would be the sign that he was a once returner. So what actually happened at Bodh Gaya wasn't without cause, wasn't without some previous events. So you could even say that his life under the Buddha Kassapa, where he would see the Dhamma, was even more important than what happened to Bodh Gaya, because that's where he got the seeing of the Dhamma, which matured as the Arahat at Bodh Gaya, but which fully matured here at Kusinara. This is a whole process of the enlightenment, from the seeing of the Dhamma of the stream winner to the fully abandoning of the defilements of an arahat, to parinibbana when everything stops and samsara is escapable. Many of you have heard me ask this question before. If you've heard this, please don't answer it, even for the other people to think. After Bodh Gaya, up until Kusinara, the Buddha was an arahat. Did he suffer? Or was he free from suffering? Do arahats experience dukkha? dukkha is suffering. If you think that arahats experience dukkha, put your hand up. Put your hands down. If you think that arahats are free from dukkha, put your hand up. About 50-50. But actually the first ones, because you've never said it before, you're the right ones. The arahat Advodraya, the Buddha extinguished the cause of dukkha for the future. We still have the remaining dukkha from the previous causes to deal with, which is one of the reasons why here at Bodhgaya, here at Krishnanala, the Buddha experienced physical suffering, the sickness, and tiredness, as was mentioned there, the dukkha of old age. The arahant at the attainment has destroyed the future causes of suffering. He still has to deal with the suffering caused by the past. A good example of that is Angulimala. Angulimala, the serial killer, we talk about him at Sarvati because that's the area where he lived, became enlightened under the Buddha, but still had some of the karma of being a murderer to deal with after his enlightenment. He certainly suffered. And eventually, at his parinibbana, then all suffering was completely ended. So at Bodhgaya, the Buddha ended the cause of suffering. Here at Krishnanala, he ended suffering. So this is actually the culmination of the whole process. The event of Bodhgaya was an important part of that process. But really, the reason I said this is, for me, the most important, this is where the process actually finally came to an end. Could he not have done it? Could he mean to stop? No. There's no way to stop these things because this whole process is an automatic, natural process. It cannot be stopped, cannot be altered with. It's a nature. That's why it's called Dhamma. Another meaning of the word Dhamma is like nature, natural process, like a natural law. So at that particular time, even from the time of streaming and seeing the Dhamma, the process becomes irreversible. Seven lifetimes have merged. For all beings, no one can actually alter that natural law. Which is why that when he was born at Lumbini, he knew this is my last night. It can be not a second. Now he was his enlightenment. He mentioned so many times Kina Jati, birth has been destroyed. Tatankaraniyan, done what needs to be done. Naparangiti Tayati, there's no more of this. All gone. Many, many times he said those things. Being has been destroyed. For me, if they've got cold or hay fever or something, then they sort of, their eyes might water, but not out of sadness, not out of grief. Arahats do not have grief or sadness. One's saying if there might be some physical cause for the crying, maybe it's like if they were peeling onions, say, for the crying. I don't know what they would do peeling onions, because if they were peeling onions, they would cry. Because it's a natural cause, but not out of grief or sadness. Yeah?
That's correct. And then the second half of the story seems to be a lot of fuss about getting the diamonds and the guys and the diamonds going to be.
That's right, yeah.
So
okay, well, that is, yes. I mean, first of all, that I pointed out the Buddha actually told Ananda, said, look, don't worry about the Buddha's remains, let the lay people look after them. so that in real matters we just not worry about those remains, because a real relic of the Buddha is not following his kept students, it's Dhamma, the teaching, the path. That's the relic of the Buddha. There's one very famous saying, we never actually got to the Black Rock at Rajagir, but that was where there was a monk called Wakali who committed suicide. And Wakali was he was a monk who had the most faith in the Buddha. And so he just wanted to look upon the Buddha all day. And just, almost as an attachment to the form of the Buddha. And so the Buddha has to teach him this beautiful saying. He said, look, this is just my body, that's all. Sort of, he who sees the Buddha sees the Dhamma. You see the Dhamma, you see the Buddha. Not the, this, you know, the form was not the Buddha. It's what the Buddha represented, the Dhamma. That was what the real Buddha was. And so there's a marvellous teaching there. It's the Dhamma which is important. So the relic of the Buddha was actually the Dhamma. However, sometimes people need physical mementos or something tangible for them to worship. And of course that's where, after many years, many centuries, we've got Buddha statues and we've got these other things. Instead of just the empty seat or the footprint or these other things which were trying to take away the person away from the Dhamma. And same with relics. But still, because people have got faith, and because of the power of the mind, the relics, they are important, they're fascinating. And sometimes, people of our world, they like to see miracles every now and again, because they think, see all of these things in the time of the Buddha about Buddha disappearing on one part of the Ganges and appearing on the other side of the Ganges, about heavenly flowers dropping out of the sky and all this sort of stuff. And people demand miracles somewhere or other, and there's relics give you those miracles every now and again. That's one of the most common of miracles in Buddhism. The people who have relics to see them disappear or multiply. And if they've got good faith, if they do puja, services. And that's happened just so often, many, many places. And it's actually good in the sense that you realise that there are some things which go beyond science. The people have these little relics in their caskets, and the caskets, you can actually see them in there, you count them one day and there's so many, you count them another day, they've increased. And that should give you faith. Or they've disappeared, and that should get you very worried about what you're doing. And it is common that happens. The people have their little relics, and sometimes they disappear. Usually because you're being heedless. Sometimes that you've got those relics and sometimes you're surprised that they increase. Now one example of that is our little Buddhist fellowship over in Singapore, because they are business people, highly educated graduates, and they did not have much faith in those sorts of things until they got some relics over from Burma. And as soon as they got some relics, they multiplied. It's great for the Buddhist fellowship in Singapore, actually, to get their faith in some things which are supernatural. So relics have got a little place nowadays in just the simple supernormal events, relics increasing or decreasing. So if you're fortunate enough to have some relics, and you have them in home, just count them every now and again and just see if they're increasing or decreasing. And of course, if you see your... Sorry? These little crystals which people give to you, like holy monks or good monks or whatever, if you go to our monastery, you see that Ajahn put a marvellous display of all the relics which we've got in our monastery. And you can see relics of these different monks, modern monks, monks from the time of the Buddha. Have a look at them. Count them and see what happens.
Yeah.
I think sometimes you like to go a bit far with some of these people. Because, I mean, sometimes there's so many relics there. But, you know, then again, sometimes it's people's faith. There's a very good story, and it's a Tibetan story, and it's one about relics, which is makes a point. There, many years ago, it's a standard story. There was a woman who lived in Lhasa, who was a very devout Buddhist, and her son was import-export, to go on the Himalayas, actually into India, selling Tibetan goods, and then with the money buying Indian goods, bringing them over back over the passes and selling them around Tibet, and then going backwards and forwards. That's how he made his money, import-export, the old style. And so one day his mother, before he's going to go to India again, he said, "Son, you're going to the land of the Buddha, can you please go and get me some relics?" He said, "Certainly, Mum." And so he went to do his business in India. And you know what children are like, they forget. So he actually was, you know, on the pass, he just saw Lhasa in the distance, thinking, "Oh my goodness, I forgot my mum's relics." And so when he went back home, he apologised, "Oh, I'm sorry, Mum, I'll be going back to India in a few more months, I'll get you some the next time." And so the next time he went to India, he determined he's going to get some relics. But, you know, business being business, and very busy, and he forgot a second time. So he told his mother, "I'm terribly, terribly sorry, next time I'll certainly get you some relics." So he went over to India a third time, and these things are always done three times in Buddhism. Tibetan Buddhism, Theravada Buddhism, the whole lot, always did three times. And he was, in the past, you know, going back home to Tibet, he saw Lhasa in this, and he thought, "Oh my goodness, I've forgotten the third time. I forgot my mother's relics. I can't apologise three times. What am I going to do?" And scratching his head, thinking what to do, he noticed, just on one of the ravines, just to his left, there was a carcass of a dead dog, you know, sort of fallen over there and smashed its head in. And he thought, "Well, my mother's silly old woman. She won't know a dog bone from a Buddha relic." So he clambered down, got a bone from the dog, and just to, you know, for special effects, he wrapped it up in this very, very expensive cloth which he'd got in India. And so when he went back home, his mother said, "Have you got my relics, son?" And he said, "Yes, Mum, here's your Buddha relic." It's only a dog bone. But his mother had so much faith. She looked at it, she started crying, she bowed to it, she put it in a proper position on her shrine, and he thought, "Okay, satisfies the silly old woman." And then he went off to sell his goods. A week or two later, when he came back to his home, he found this big crowd around his house. So what's going on? Has something gone wrong? And he pushed his way in because it was his house. And then, having pushed through the people, there's this big crowd of lamas outside. So what's going on? He says, "It's my home." So he pushed his way through all these monks. And when he got into the room, there was all these head lamas there, and his wife, and his mum, sorry. And this bone was emanating these beautiful rays of golden light from the shrine. It was a miracle. And the question was, was that a dog bone? Or was it a Buddha bone? A Buddha relic? Had it changed because of the woman's faith? The Devas would have actually swapped that bone as soon as possible because of the woman's faith. And it's actually supposed to, people say it's a true story, I'm not quite sure if it is true, but it makes a lot of sense. If you really have that faith, the Devas will get you a real bone. And you know where they get it from? From people who don't worship their bones. So, pinch it from here and give it from the Devas. There was, in the Buddhist Society of Victoria, I'm the spiritual advisor, had a past president, who was a Sri Lankan doctor, who was given his Buddhist relics, I think, by a Thai monk. And so, Buddha relics, these aren't real relics. You know, this is more relic, you can build a mountain with all the Buddha relics in the world, or something like that. So, you know, he accepted the relics just, you know, to humour this monk. Instead of taking them to the temple, he put them in his cupboard. Now, on the top of the cupboard, all the other bric-a-brac in his house. He remembered it only after 1 year. He told me about it. And after about a year later, he remembered, oh, I've got these relics. I should, the meaning to take them to the temple, so he took them to the temple, but they'd all disappeared. You should not keep relics in an old cupboard with all the other bric-a-brac. So yes, you've got a lot of faith. He's very scared about this, but you've got a lot of faith that these things actually work. They do disappear. And other people have seen them increase. That's like relics. They're strange things. Again, being a scientist, you never believe these things, so you start to see them with your own eyes. That's why a few times when I go to these places, sometimes we're very sensitive and feel things have got energy. If you've got real Buddha relics, you've really got a lot of energy. When you go to Delhi, you see, of all the relics in the world, they have got the best pedigree. They're the ones you can actually trace back from this time, Kusanhara, to Kapilavastu, and Kapilavastu to Delhi. Certain progression. That's where you see the four relics and one of the portions of eight, which were distributed. That's very impressive. Wait till you get there, it's going to blow your mind. When we first time we came on pilgrimage, I think over here, we were just, what was just actually getting it right. We were trying to find places. One of the hotels we stayed, just outside of Sarvati, we had a choice. One hotel was, had lots of ghosts in it and no one could sleep. And the other hotel had rats. So we went to the one with rats, which wasn't very nice. So don't complain about the hotels you're in. These are great hotels, what we spent the first time. Now, because people wanted to go to the Taj Mahal, because they're in India, we stop that now, because if you want to go to the Taj Mahal, you can come another time. This is a Buddhist pilgrimage. So we had to go to Agra, and we were flying out from Delhi. So we had an afternoon in Delhi, so we thought, let's go and see the Buddha statues. But I had an intuition there may be some Buddha relics there. So I told a few of the disciples when we got to the Delhi Museum, just like the museum we had in Patna, there's no guidebooks, there's no guides. If you try and ask somebody where things are, they'll just look at you and just say rupee or something. But they still won't help you. So I said to these people just looking, I said, go look for some Buddha relics. And I still remember to this day, you know, Wayne Finn, he came running back to me and said, I found some. And so I got everyone together and we marched into this room. We didn't find just any old ones, we found the ones from Kapilavastu. Can you imagine how that hits you? Wow. Real relics. There's a big sign out there. Silence. I'm sorry. It's if he's so fucking. We just chanted in that poor voice. Just out of faith. They couldn't keep us quiet. Didn't care if we went to jail. I was going to do puja. They're really powerful relics. Anyway, any other questions we've got? Okay, yeah, last question over here, because it's almost time for breakfast, yeah?
I was
told that there was a reclining Buddha, and then you went for a Buddha for that statue. And then you said that there's a new property, why is that being, and when is that being? Okay, this is just a story. The reclining Buddha, that obviously represents the Mahaparinibbana, facing north on its right side, and the pictures underneath, especially the one monk who is sitting meditating quietly and the other monk who is crying. That was a dead giveaway that that's the Mahaparinibbana statue. Not other times the Buddha would lie on his right side, but this was a time lying on his right side with the monk underneath crying, one being still and the other one paying veneration. Also there's other inscription found out in this place, which was Kusanhara. And that statue was found destroyed in fragments. It was put together again by the British about over 100 years ago. And they built the temple over it. They had old stones, descriptions of a temple by the Chinese pilgrims, and so they rebuilt it. And I think they did a pretty good job, because that's probably as it was, or pretty much as it was in the time of the Chinese pilgrims. And also they did it in the right place, because they said it was just to the west of the stupa, which was there. Those little temples which we saw, those viharas, with the little cubicles, the little matsas on the outside, in the central area where there was either a place of worship, a stupa or a Buddha statue. In one of those temples, there would have been that Buddha statue as a central feature in the main quadrangle, the courtyard in the center. That was actually found in the area by the Burmese monk, or was excavated by the British. He saw it and took it away and built that little image house on the opposite side of the road. It's actually very important he did that, because otherwise the British would probably send it off to the Victorian Albert Museum or somewhere, or end up in Calcutta. So the Burmese monk got to it first and put it in that little shrine. It's a very beautiful statue. The thing is, it belongs here. This is where it started out. It would have been the central image in one of those quadrangular viharas around the Mahaprabhupada temple. If the British did take those relics, the devils would have taken them back again. They would have disappeared. This happens. It is vanished. And they go somewhere else where they're more needed. Okay, I think that's enough now. Tomorrow we wake up call is 4:30. 4:30, it's only wake up call. I think you probably all got used to it now. You pick up the phone saying, good boy, put it down again, and carry on sleeping. Because at 5:30 the stomach gives you a wake up call. It's called the breakfast wake up call. And that's irresistible. You don't put that one down, you get up and you go for breakfast. That's at 5:30. But again, get your bags out by 5:30, because put it in front of your room so they'll be going into the coach. And we leave at 6:30 tomorrow morning. 6:30 depart on the coaches. Because we've got to go over the border from India into Nepal. And you know, because there has been trouble in Nepal over the last month or two, there may be difficulty going across. It should be okay, because we're a long way away from the central Nepal. And this little area here is a Buddhist area. And I was actually told by one of the Nepalese monks, the novices, that actually the leader of the Maoist rebellion was a Buddhist. He actually wrote some books on Buddhism before. I don't know about how he squares being a Buddhist with going in open rebellion, but nevertheless, if you get captured by the Maoists, they're Buddhists, so you'll be okay. And if you get captured by the Royalists, you're tourists, so you're okay. So both ways you're okay. But the point is that we're way away from where all the action is, and so it'd be very, very safe. So don't have to worry about it. But just pass them on the border, maybe stricter controls at this time. So it may take a bit more time. That's what we have to do. And get to Lumbini. For those of you going across the area, I will promise you that tomorrow evening you will be in Nirvana. Hotel Nirvana. And don't forget to get your photo taken next to the big sign saying Hotel Nirvana. On the outside, a very nice hotel. And in the afternoon we'll go to the beach. Okay, let's say take a good night on the sand and then we'll go to the rest.
Arahant Sambhava Sambuddho Bhagava Bhutan Bhagavata Kapivade Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Suvati Pāra